This is the UK's home of live news and live sport.
Five Live.
Importantly, we talked to David Cassidy. His autobiography is Could It Be Forever? My Story. David, you were talking just before the news about the madness of hotels and thousands of people outside and screaming. It was mad in this country. Was it mad everywhere?
Yes, it was. It was just, I would say, is out of control in every country except possibly, I mean, Japan was, there were thousands of kids chasing me and stuff, but they were oddly, somehow or another, somewhat polite. And Germany wasn't quite, the first time I played Germany was a little odder. But yes, for the most part, the reaction was the same, and it's good to be back and be able to stay at hotels now because they banned me from them because I was stopping traffic and all the rest of it, which was never my intention. But it's a beautiful thing to be able to have fans who care about you but who also care about listening. And now they do that as opposed to just screaming.
And there are many people listening who won't need any explanation at all as to what it was like in the 70s. But I do wonder if for some other people, this is a lost world.
It's a lost world.
A couple of TV channels where if you were a star in a show like The Partridge Family, everybody, absolutely everybody within that sort of demographic who were likely to watch it, they knew exactly who you were, and that world is gone now.
Yes, and the reason that world is gone is because we've, as a society, we've become so devouring of media and celebrity-obsessed that there are 150 channels through dish, various kinds of dishes. It's instant information all over the world via the internet and the satellite dishes, etc. There was no video. So in a way, as you quite rightly pointed out, like 90% of the demographic between the ages of 3 and 17 or 18 years old on a Friday night in America or on a Saturday morning here in the UK, that demographic, 90% of them were watching The Partridge Family, so it was instantaneous. And there were only two or three channels, as you said.
The world is this extraordinary story. You've got lots of detail in your book as to quite how mad it was.
Yeah.
You do say at the beginning of the book, David, that you are no longer the same person that you were then. Obviously, you get older and wiser, and your back goes a bit.
Yes, that's just does as well.
That's just part of the deal.
But it is, isn't
but
it?
But in what sense are you not the same person that was in that hotel room with the fans outside?
Well, I believe that there is, in fact, a blueprint for us as human beings that we, as human beings, have general characteristics as teenagers, as in our 20s, as in our 30s, as in our 40s, in our 50s. And so on. And I believe that because of the remarkable journey that my life and career has made and taken, that I feel very incredibly lucky, gifted, fortunate, and all of the above and below, because I have been given such a great gift by having people genuinely care about me all over the world and allow me to do what I love to do that I don't necessarily do anything else very well, but writing, performing, singing, acting, producing and writing are the things I do, and I love to perform. I think given the chance, 37 years I have been doing this successfully. I just realized this morning, that my career began on Broadway. When I look back on it, it was 39 years ago.
Wow.
I can remember my father saying to me when I was a kid, I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. And I thought, that's impossible. I've been doing this nearly 40 years. And I'm having more fun now than I ever have. And a lot of my journey and my own personal story, my father abandoned me and the dramatic impact it had. He was brilliant. He was remarkably talented. He was bipolar. He was manic depressive, and he was alcoholic. And he was also the most narcissistic man I ever met. And you put all that into one man, the charismatic aspect of it, the need to have people's attention. And he was life and death. His, while he was alive, to be successful, famous, to be a movie star, and never was. And his wife, his second wife, not my mom, but Shirley Jones, became an overnight sensation. And then his son, David Cassidy, became David Cassidy, an overnight sensation. So he was tortured by it. And the more famous and the more successful I became, the more he was tortured and resented me. And that was the most difficult pill for me to swallow.
Did he always want to be that leading man that you had become?
Yes. He wanted to be, basically, he lived in another time. As a little boy, I believe he saw John Barrymore. I think it was Grand Hotel. I remember him telling me, and there were articles written about him during the course of his career, because he did over 40 Broadway shows, and he was arguably the most respected theatrical actor of his time, and won Tony Awards, and everyone who worked with him, you know, they respected his work ethic and his talent, where he could do virtually anything. He also was a brilliant singer, and they could never pigeonhole him quite. And I think because he never achieved the kind of success and fame that either his wife Shirley Jones or his son did, I think it tortured him.
Yeah, and I mean, he looms large through an awful lot of the book, and you do pinpoint the moment when your dad admitted that he got divorced from your mum as an absolutely precise moment where an awful lot of your problems flowed from.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I can remember exactly where on the road we were driving to Manhattan, and I was being kidded and sort of teased on the street by the older kids who, I'm sure, whose parents said, you know, isn't that a shame? Because it wasn't really acceptable in the environment I grew up in, which was very working class. We call it WASP, white American.
Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was not considered something socially acceptable to be divorced. So my friends on the street were kidding me and teasing me, going, your parents are divorced, you know, all of that stuff. And I would say, no, they're not. You know, I was 4 years old, 5 years old, and my father came and picked me up on a weekend. And I didn't think much of it because he was always on the road. It wasn't like, why isn't Dad living here now with us? I said, are you and Mom divorced? And he turned to me, I'll never forget it. He looked at me while he was driving and said, yes, just like that. And my whole body shook, and I felt myself, for the first time, I felt myself lose control of my body. I became inconsolable. It shattered my life in a moment. It shattered it. So I guess being lied to was part of that equation as well, because they'd been separated and divorced, and in fact he had remarried since I was 3 and a half, and this was probably when I was 5 or 6. So very traumatic, and a lot of the book is really very revealing, I think.
But you wanted to be like him. I mean, clearly that was all the bad stuff, but he was a Broadway star.
Well, I worshipped him, and as did my brothers, I might add, Sean, Patrick, and Ryan, and I guess by their names you can probably tell he was very proud of his Irish descent, as am I, for that matter. But he never achieved the kind of universal or even national fame and credibility that he had on the stage in New York, which is really where he and his career and his life came about.
One of the really interesting things in the book is because I think everyone associates you with being a 70s kid, really, because that's when you had your hit records. That's when
particularly over here in the UK.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whereas, actually, you're a 60s kid, and you talk all about that, all the kind of wild stuff that was going on. So you emerged into this happy family with trouser suits with a 60s attitude.
I did. And I I had hitched up to the Haight-Ashbury in 67, the Summer of Love, with a friend of mine, went to Golden Gate Park, and they were handing out purple Osley acid. And I had seen Hendrix four or five times. I'd seen Cream and the Velvet Underground. I was really into the blues, B.B. King and Albert King and Muddy Waters. And I was into a very different alternative kind of music than the straight-ahead pop stuff, which I think we executed. And the character I played, which the music was designed for, I worked with some of the greatest writers of all time. You know, Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, Jerry Goffin, Tony Romeo. I wrote with Brian Wilson. And I got to work with some of the most incredible talents that we would put into a pop category, which is short for popular. I think that's important. And it became, you know, instantly, the first recording I ever made was I Think I Love You, which became the record of the year. My first album did like almost 4 million units, which in those days, when you're talking albums, I was with a company that hadn't sold 150,000. So if you think about them taking on an artist and having the artist emerge when they've never sold more than 150,000 albums, and my first album sells 3.5 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it was they didn't know what to do. They had no concept it could ever get this big, and it overwhelmed everybody and me as well, I might add.
And all the time you were making that kind of music, Partridge Family Records and David Cassidy hit singles, were you thinking, I wish I could play the blues. I wish I could do a bit of rock, because that was the stuff that you were into, really.
Yeah, but I also appreciated the fact that I was working with the greatest musicians in the history of recording, in my opinion, and studio musicians that Hal Blaine played on all, virtually, of the Beach Boys records, including Smile and Good Vibrations and all of the Mamas and Papas and all of those great records, Sonny and Cher. I mean, you can't imagine the wealth of talent in one room. Larry Carlton, the great guitar player. Louis Shelton, the same. Mike Melvoin is the head of the American Musicians Association. And in truth, they were so sophisticated that it was their simplicity in the arrangements that are, and their own signatures to them, that made those records so, I think, well choreographed, and the great simple pop but live recordings that I would go in the booth and sing live. A lot of the vocals were live vocals that ended up on those records. Almost all of them, in fact.
Some listeners' questions here. This is Irene, who's in Upton on the Wirral, says, David, I followed your career intently. I think that's a word chosen wisely, since 1972, and have been fortunate to see on a number of occasions in concert and in theatre shows over this time. I hope to undertake a qualitative academic study into why people see David Cassidy in concert later this year, and I'm going to interview up to 30 individuals who attend a number of concerts across the UK to determine this. I'm then going to analyse the data using the principles of phenomenology and write up the findings as an academic thesis. And Irene just says, do I have your permission to continue with this study?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Irene, thank you. And I'm more than flattered. I'm a little astounded by that. But it is a kind of fascinating experience for me as well. So I can only tell you, I don't know another artist who has come and been extremely successful, has walked away from it, and not come back to this country or done any work at all for over a decade, and have them be as loving, supportive, responsive, you know, in a way that overwhelms me, particularly coming here or going outside of America, where I've done thousands and thousands of shows, as well as television and film, and that you know, people would never see over here. So that's what constantly blows my mind, and that I do begin my concert tour here on April 10th, and I do it actually, the first show's in Glasgow, but I'm in London on the 15th, I think.
Do you still do The Last Kiss? I always thought that was a fine record.
Yes, I wrote that song with Alan Tarney, who is a very brilliant writer, producer, musician. And in fact, at one point, he and the writing partner that my wife had, Terry Britton, who wrote What's Love Got to Do with It, they were in the same band that backed up Cliff Richard for a number of years.
I'd say for all the women who and some men who...
And some men now come out of the closet.
Who were very much in love with you. There are lots of blokes my age who really resented you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no question.
Were the girls interested in us? No, of course they weren't. Were they interested in you or Donnie?
Yeah,
you know, you were either a David or Donnie.
Right.
And you kind of carved it all up between you. Thanks very much.
Simon, listen, I can only tell you that from the deepest part of my heart, how sympathetic I am, because I grew up as a teenager with the Beatles, and all of my girlfriends were not in love with me. They were in love with Paul, John, George, or Ringo.
Yeah, but you've made up for it since.
Yeah, I have done.
And last night when I was trying to do some work on your book, I was looking for it everywhere. It had disappeared. My wife was reading it. She'd taken it to bed and she was reading your book. I thought, well, even now I can't compete.
Come on.
This email from Cliff says, it's not that Cliff. Could you please ask David to say hi to my wife? And she's also suffering with a bad back and is lying here at home in Liverpool listening to your interviews. Great fan of David. Was upset that she couldn't get to any of the book signings. Can't wait to see him in concert again in April. A quick hello would really cheer her up.
What is her name?
Her name is Anne.
Anne from Liverpool. I won't disgrace my friends from Liverpool or from America for that matter by trying to do Liverpool again. I did that once. And
no, don't do that.
No, I'm not going to. I did play the role, though, on Broadway in Blood Brothers. And as soon as the real Liverpoolians left and all these crap American accents came through, I lost kind of mine. But I want to say to Anne, I'm glad that we share so much in common, that we're icing our back, and unfortunately I'm not lying in bed, but I think your husband is a wonderful guy to be able to make the effort to say, would you call and cheer up, and just know I send my love to you, and I look forward to coming over, and I'm glad you're going to come to see some of the shows in the UK when I'm here in April.
This from Tanya. I get very nostalgic when I watch Life on Mars. I don't know if you've seen any of this cop series that we've got on at the moment.
Anyway, we don't have it.
It's a guy who is set in the present day, and then he has a car crash, and he wakes up in 1973.
Great idea.
So it's like it's a 70s cop show, but with current character. Anyway, right. And it featured How Can I Be Sure? And Tanya says, took me back to when I was 14 and rumors abounded that David Cassidy would be filming for Top of the Pops in the Park our school was in. He wasn't, but the school was in absolute uproar. These were the happy, innocent days before I got into the Velvet Underground.
There you go. It just worked the other way for me. I got into the Velvet Underground, then I started making Partridge Family records, and I learned so much, and I think it's so cool that people can, you know, they have had such an incredible impact on me and my life, and hearing the stories from people who are remarkably open and happy to share the impact that I may have had on people's lives. And I can only tell you that I'm humbled by it beyond belief, and also I found myself always believing what I do is really pretty insignificant until the 9/11 tragedy happened in my country. And the Ground Zero was about a half a mile from where I was born and spent my first 4 or 5 years of my life, and where I still consider home, which is New York City. And I can only tell you that I had to do a concert 2 weeks afterwards, and I took it out on the streets of New Orleans. Instead of being in a concert hall or in a casino, I invited everyone in the city because I was so in shock and depressed during that aftermath of 9/11 that 12 Broadway shows closed. People did not leave their homes. They didn't participate in society. We just kind of all stood as one, as a nation, or sat in a chair staring against the wall. It was so painful. And I think from that moment on, when I went to New Orleans that night and I heard this roar when they announced I was coming on the stage, and this outpouring of love, and I felt so, for the first time in my life, not that I do something completely insignificant, that if you touched people's lives and you were, as we did that night, we healed together. And that's what the theater is supposed to be. That's what live performance is supposed to be. It was a magnificent thing. And I think we as our culture, because it's so hard now, it's a difficult reality. I think that we need the trivial, that somehow or another sport and music, entertainment is such an important part, because we live almost 24 hours a day working on the cell phone. Two or three decades ago, you used to pull down the curtain, lock the door at 5 o'clock. There were no faxes. There were no emails. There were no cell phones. People left their work on Friday at 5 o'clock and came back Monday morning. Now it's 24 hours a day. And as a result, what we also see is immediate, be it in Afghanistan or be it in anywhere that there is ultra-violence going on, and certainly the war in Iraq has been an enormous weight on all of us. But I think that my own take on myself and what I've been able to touch people's lives and bring some light and make them happy, and it means much more to me now, yeah, even though it meant a lot to me then.
David, I really appreciate you spending some time with us, particularly as you are in physical pain.
I am in a bit, but I have to say I'm sorry I couldn't be there physically in person, but I'll be back in a couple of weeks.
David, thank you very much indeed for your time today.